for asking, but was this your grave?
Master sets us here on the plain to God. Buries our skulls beneath this stone. Leaves us here knowing what we have to do. We guard the treasures until Master comes back.
I expect that he's forgotten all about you,
pointed out Bod.
I'm sure he's been dead himself for ages.
We are the sleer. We guard.
Bod wondered just how long ago you had to go back before the deepest tomb inside the hill was on a plain, and he knew it must have been an extremely long time ago. He could feel the sleer winding its waves of fear around him, like the tendrils of some carnivorous plant. He was beginning to feel cold and slow, as if he had been bitten in the heart by some arctic viper, and it was starting to pump its icy venom through his body. He took a step forward, so he was standing against the stone slab, and he reached down and closed his fingers around the coldness of the brooch.
Hey, we got that for the master.
He won't mind.
He took a step backward, walking toward the stone steps, avoiding the desiccated remains of people and animals on the floor. The sleer writhed angrily, twining around the tiny chamber like ghost smoke. Then it slowed.
It comes back! Always comes back!
Bod went up the stone steps inside the hill as fast as he could. At one point, he imagined that there was something coming after him. But when he broke out of the top into the Frobisher mausoleum and he could breathe the cool dawn air, nothing moved or followed. Bod sat in the open air on the top of the hill and held the brooch. He thought it was all black at first, but then the sun rose, and he could see that the stone in the centre of the black metal was a swirling red. It was the size of a robin's egg, and Bod stared into the stone, wondering if there were things moving in its heart, his eyes and soul deep in the crimson world. If Bod had been smaller, he would have wanted to put it into his mouth. The stone was held in place by a black metal clasp, by something that looked like claws, with something else crawling around it. The something else looked almost snake-like, but it had too many heads. Bod wondered if that was what the sleer looked like in the daylight. He wandered down the hill, taking all the shortcuts he knew, through the ivy tangle that covered the Bartleby family vault. And inside, the sound of the Bartlebys grumbling and readying for sleep. And on and over and through the railings and into the potter's field. He called,
Liza! Liza!
And looked around.
Good morrow, young lummox.
Bod could not see her, but there was an extra shadow beneath the hawthorn tree. And, as he approached it, the shadow resolved itself into something pearlescent and translucent in the early morning light. Something girl-like, something grey-eyed.
I should be decently sleeping. What kind of carrying on is this?
Your headstone. I wanted to know what you want on it.
My name. It must have my name on it, with a big E for Elizabeth, like the old queen that died when I was born. And a big H for Hempstock. More than that I care not, for I did never master my letters.
What about dates?
William the Conqueror, 1066.
She sang, in the whisper of the dawn wind in the hawthorn tree.
A big E, if you please, and a big H.
Did you have a job? I mean, when you weren't being a witch.
I done laundry.
And then the morning sunlight flooded the wasteland, and Bod was alone. It was 9 in the morning, when all the world is sleeping. Bod was determined to stay awake. He was, after all, on a mission. He was 8 years old, and the world beyond the graveyard held no terrors for him. Clothes. He would need clothes. His usual dress of a grey winding sheet was, he knew, quite wrong. It was good in the graveyard, the same colour as stone and as shadows, but if he was going to dare the world beyond the graveyard walls, he would need to blend in there. There were some clothes in the crypt beneath the ruined church, but Bod did not want to go down to the crypt, not even in daylight. While Bod was prepared to justify himself to Master and Mistress Owens, he was not about to explain himself to Silas. The very thought of those dark eyes, angry, or, worse still, disappointed, filled him with shame. There was a gardener's hut at the far end of the graveyard, a small green building that smelled like motor oil, and in which the old mower sat and rusted, unused, along with an assortment of ancient garden tools. The hut had been abandoned when the last gardener had retired, before Bod was born, and the task of keeping the graveyard had been shared between the council, who sent in a man to cut the grass and clean the paths once a month from April to September, and the local volunteers in the Friends of the Graveyard. A huge padlock on the door protected the contents of the hut, but Bod had long ago discovered the loose wooden board in the back. Sometimes he would go to the gardener's hut and sit and think when he wanted to be by himself. As long as he had been going to the hut, there had been a brown working man's jacket hanging on the back of the door, forgotten or abandoned years before, along with a green-stained pair of gardening jeans. The jeans were much too big for him, but he rolled up the cuffs until his feet showed. Then he made a belt out of brown garden twine and tied it around his waist. There were boots in one corner, and he tried putting them on, but they were so big and encrusted with mud and concrete that he could barely shuffle in them. And if he took a step, the boots remained on the floor of the shed. He pushed the jacket out through the space in the loose board, squeezed himself out, then put it on. If he rolled up the sleeves, he decided, it worked quite well. It had big pockets, and he thrust his hands into them, and felt quite the dandy. Bod walked down to the main gate of the graveyard and looked out through the bars. A bus rattled past in the street. There were cars there, and noise and shops. Behind him, a cool green shade, overgrown with trees and ivy. Home. His heart pounding, Bod walked out into the world. Abenazar Bolger had seen some odd types in his time. If you owned a shop like Abenazar's, you'd see them too. The shop in the Warrenet streets in the old town, a little bit antique shop, a little bit junk shop, a little bit pawnbrokers, and not even Abenazar himself was entirely certain which bit was which, brought odd types and strange people, some of them wanting to buy, some of them needing to sell. Abenazar Bolger traded over the counter, buying and selling, and he did a better trade behind the counter and in the back room, accepting objects that may not have been acquired entirely honestly and then quietly shifting them on. His business was an iceberg. Only the dusty little shop was visible on the surface. The rest of it was underneath, and that was just how Abenazar Bolger wanted it. Abenazar Bolger had thick spectacles, and a permanent expression of mild distaste, as if he had just realized that the milk in his tea had been on the turn, and he could not get the sour taste of it out of his mouth. The expression served him well when people tried to sell him things.
"Honestly,"
he would tell them, sour-faced,
"it's not really worth anything at all. I'll give you what I can, though, as it has sentimental value."
You were lucky to get anything like what you thought you wanted from Abanazar Bulger. A business like Abanazar Bulger's brought in strange people, but the boy who came in that morning was one of the strangest Abanazar could remember in a lifetime of cheating strange people out of their valuables. He looked to be about 7 years old and dressed in his grandfather's clothes. He smelled like a shed. His hair was long and shaggy, and he seemed extremely grave. His hands were deep in the pockets of a dusty brown jacket, but even with the hands out of sight, Abanazar could see that something was clutched extremely tightly, protectively, in the boy's right hand.
Excuse me.
Aye, aye, Sonny Jim. Kids,
he thought.
Either they've nicked something or they're trying to sell their toys.
Either way, he usually said no. Buy stolen property from a kid, and next thing you knew, you'd have an enraged adult accusing you of having given little Johnny or Matilda a tenner for their wedding ring. More trouble than they were worth, kids.
I need something for a friend of mine, and I thought maybe you could buy something I've got.
I don't buy stuff from kids.
Bod took his hand out of his pocket and put the brooch down on the grimy countertop. Bulger glanced down at it. Then he looked at it. He removed his spectacles. He took an eyepiece from the countertop and he screwed it into his eye. He turned on a little light on the counter and examined the brooch through the eyeglass.
Snake stone,
he said, to himself, not to the boy. Then he took the eyepiece out, replaced his glasses, and fixed the boy with a sour and suspicious look.
Where did you get this?
Do you want to buy it?
You stole it. You've nicked this from a museum or somewhere, didn't you?
No. Are you going to buy it, or shall I go and find somebody who will?
Abanazar Bulger's sour mood changed then. Suddenly he was all affability. He smiled broadly.
I'm sorry. It's just you don't see many pieces like this. Not in a shop like this, not outside of the museum. But I would certainly like it. Tell you what, why don't we sit down over tea and biscuits? I've got a packet of chocolate chip cookies in the back room, and decide how much something like this is worth, eh?
Bod was relieved that the man was finally being friendly.
I need enough to buy a stone. A headstone for a friend of mine. Well, she's not really my friend, just someone I know. I think she helped make my leg better, you see.
Abanazar Bulger, paying little attention to the boy's prattle, led him behind the counter and opened the door to the storeroom, a windowless little space, every inch of which was crammed high with teetering cardboard boxes, each filled with junk. There was a safe in there, in the corner, a big old one. There was a box filled with violins, an accumulation of stuffed dead animals, chairs without seats, books and prints. There was a small desk beside the door, and Abanazar Bulger pulled up the only chair and sat down, letting Bod stand. Abanazar rummaged in a drawer, in which Bod could see a half-empty bottle of whiskey, and pulled out an almost finished packet of chocolate chip cookies, and he offered one to the boy. He turned on the desk light, looked at the brooch again, the swirls of red and orange in the stone, and he examined the black metal band that encircled it, suppressing a little shiver at the expression on the heads of the snake things.
This is old. It's priceless,
he thought.
Probably not really worth much, but you never know.
Bald's face fell. Abenazar Bulger tried to look reassuring.
I just need to know that it's not stolen, though, before I can give you a penny. Did you take it from your mum's dresser? Nick it from a museum? You can tell me. I'll not get you into trouble. I just need to know.
Bod shook his head. He munched on his cookie.
Then where did you get it?
Bod said nothing. Abenazar Bulger did not want to put down the brooch, but he pushed it across the desk to the boy.
If you can't tell me, you'd better take it back. There has to be trust on both sides, after all. Nice doing business with you. Sorry it couldn't go any further.
Bod looked worried.
I found it in an old grave. But I can't say where.
He stopped, because naked greed and excitement had replaced the friendliness on Abenazar Bulger's face.
And there's more like this there?
If you don't want to buy it, I'll find someone else. Thank you for the biscuit.
You're in a hurry, eh? Mum and Dad waiting for you, I expect.
The boy shook his head, then wished he had nodded.
Nobody waiting. Good.
Abenazar Bulger closed his hands around the brooch.
Now, you tell me exactly where you found this, eh?
I don't remember.
Too late for that. Suppose you have a little think for a bit about where it came from. Then, when you've thought, we'll have a little chat, and you'll tell me.
He got up and walked out of the room, closing the door behind him. He locked it with a large metal key. He opened his hand and looked at the brooch and smiled hungrily. There was a ding from the bell above the shop door to let him know someone had entered. And he looked up, guiltily. But there was no one there. The door was slightly ajar, though, and Bulger pushed it shut, and then, for good measure, he turned around the sign in the window, so it said closed. He pushed the bolt shut. Didn't want any busybodies turning up today. The autumn day had turned from sunny to grey, and a light patter of rain ran down the grubby shop window. Abenazar Bulger picked up the telephone from the counter and pushed at the buttons with fingers that barely shook.
Pay dirt, Tom. Get over here soon as you can.
Bod realized that he was trapped when he heard the lock turn in the door. He pulled on the door, but it held fast. He felt stupid by having been lured inside, foolish for not trusting his first impulses to get as far away from the sour-faced man as possible. He had broken all the rules of the graveyard, and everything had gone wrong. What would Silas say, or the Owenses? He could feel himself beginning to panic, and he suppressed it, pushing the worry back down inside him. It would all be good. He knew that. Of course, he needed to get out. He examined the room he was trapped in. It was little more than a storeroom with a desk in it. The only entrance was the door. He opened the desk drawer, finding nothing but small pots of paint, used for brightening up antiques, and a paintbrush. He wondered if he would be able to throw paint in the man's face and blind him for long enough to escape. He opened the top of a pot of paint and dipped in his finger.
What are you doing?
Nothing,
said Bod, screwing the top on the paint pot and dropping it into one of the jacket's enormous pockets. Liza Hempstock looked at him, unimpressed.
Why are you in here? And who's old bag of lard out there?
It's his shop. I was trying to sell him something.
Why?
None of your beeswax,
she sniffed.
Well, you should get on back to the graveyard.
I can't. He's locked me in.
Course you can. Just slip through the wall.
He shook his head.
I can't. I can only do it at home because they gave me the freedom of the graveyard when I was a baby.
He looked up at her, under the electric light. It was hard to see her properly, but Bard had spent his life talking to dead people.
Anyway, what are you doing here? What are you doing out from the graveyard? It's daytime. And you're not like Silas. You're meant to stay in the graveyard.
There's rules for those in graveyards, but not for those as was buried in unhallowed ground. Nobody tells me what to do or where to go.
She glared at the door.
I don't like that man. I'm going to see what he's doing.
A flicker, and Bard was alone in the room once more. He heard a rumble of distant thunder. In the cluttered darkness of Bulger's antiquities, Abanazar Bulger looked up suspiciously, certain that someone was watching him. Then realized he was being foolish.
The boy's locked in the room? The front door's locked?
He was polishing the metal clasp surrounding the snake stone as gently and as carefully as an archaeologist on a dig, taking off the black and revealing the glittering silver beneath it. He was beginning to regret calling Tom Hustings over, although Hustings was big and good for scaring people. He was also beginning to regret that he was going to have to sell the brooch when he was done. It was special. The more it glittered under the tiny light on his counter, the more he wanted it to be his, and only his. There was more where this came from, though. The boy would tell him. The boy would lead him to it. The boy. An idea struck him. He put down the brooch reluctantly and opened a drawer behind the counter, taking out a metal biscuit tin filled with envelopes and cards and slips of paper. He reached in and took out a card only slightly larger than a business card. It was black-edged. There was no name or address printed on it, though. Only one word, handwritten in the centre, in an ink that had faded to brown. Jack. On the back of the card, in pencil, Abanazar Bulger had written instructions to himself, in his tiny, precise handwriting, as a reminder. Although he would not have been likely to forget the use of the card. How to use it to summon the man, Jack. No, not summon. Invite. You did not summon people like him. A knocking on the outer door of the shop. Bulger tossed the card down onto the counter and walked over to the door, peering out into the wet afternoon.
Hurry up. It's miserable out here. Dismal. I'm getting soaked.
Bulger unlocked the door, and Tom Hustings pushed his way in, his raincoat and hair dripping.
What's so important that you can't talk about it over the phone, then?
Our fortune, that's what,
said Abanazar Bulger with his sour face. Hustings took off his raincoat and hung it on the back of the shop door.
What is it? Something good fell off the back of a lorry?
Treasure. Two kinds.
He took his friend over to the counter, showed him the brooch under the little light.
It's old, isn't it?
From pagan times, before. From Druid times, before the Romans came. It's called a snake stone. Seen them in museums. I've never seen metalwork like that, or one so fine. Must have belonged to a king. The lad who found it says it come from a grave. Think of a barrow filled with stuff like this.
Might be worth doing it legit. Declare it as treasure trove. They have to pay us market value for it, and we could make them name it after us. The Hustings Bulger Bequest.
Bulger Hustings. There's a few people I know of, people with real money, would pay more than market value if they could hold it as you are.
For Tom Hustings was fingering the brooch, gently, like a man stroking a kitten.
And there'd be no questions asked.
He reached out his hand, and, reluctantly, Tom Hustings passed him the brooch.
You said two kinds of treasure. What's t'other?
Abanazar Bolger picked up the black-edged card, held it out for his friend's inspection.
Do you know what this is?
His friend shook his head. Abanazar put the card down on the counter.
There's a party. He's looking for another party.
So?
The way I heard it, the other party is a boy.
There's boys everywhere, running all around, getting into trouble. Well, I can't abide them. So, there's a party looking for a particular boy.
This lad looks to be the right sort of age. He's dressed, well, you'll see how he's dressed. And he found this. It could be him.
And if it is him?
Abanazar Bolger picked up the card again by the edge and waved it back and forth, slowly, as if running the edge along an imaginary flame.
Here comes a candle to light you to bed.
And here comes a chopper to chop off your head. But look you, if we call the man Jack, we lose the boy. And if we lose the boy, we lose the treasure.
And the two men went back and forth on it, weighing the merits and disadvantages of reporting the boy or of collecting the treasure, which had grown in their minds to a huge underground cavern filled with precious things. And as they debated, Abanazar pulled a bottle of slow gin from beneath the counter and poured them both a generous tot.
To assist the celebrations.
Liza was soon bored with their discussion, which went back and forth and around like a whirligig, getting nowhere. And so she went back into the storeroom, to find Bod standing in the middle of the room with his eyes tightly closed and his fists clenched and his face all screwed up, as if he had a toothache, almost purple from holding his breath.
What are you doing of now?
He opened his eyes and relaxed.
Trying to fade.
Liza sniffed.
Try again.
He did, holding his breath even longer this time.
Stop that, or you'll pop.
Bod took a deep breath and then sighed.
It doesn't work. Maybe I could hit him with a rock and just run for it.
There wasn't a rock. So he picked up a coloured glass paperweight, hefted it in his hand, wondering if he could throw it hard enough to stop Abanazar Bolger in his tracks.
There's two of them out there now, and if the one don't get you, t'other one will. They say they want to get you to show them where you got the brooch, and then dig up the grave and take the treasure.
She did not tell him about the other discussions they were having, nor about the black-edged card. She shook her head.
Why did you do something as stupid as this anyway? You know the rules about leaving the graveyard. Just asking for trouble it was.
Bod felt very insignificant and very foolish.
I wanted to get you a headstone. And I thought it would cost more money. So I was going to sell him the brooch to buy you one.
She didn't say anything.
Are you angry?
She shook her head.
It's the first nice thing anyone's done for me in 500 years,
she said, with a hint of a goblin smile.
Why would I be angry? What do you do when you try to fade?
What Mr. Pennyworth told me. I am an empty doorway. I am a vacant alley. I am nothing. Eyes will not see me. Glances slip over me. But it never works.
It's because you're alive. There's stuff as works for us, the dead, who have to fight to be noticed at the best of times, that won't never work for you people.
She hugged herself tightly, moving her body back and forth as if she was debating something.
It's because of me you got into this. Come here, Nobody Owens.
He took a step towards her, in that tiny room. And she put her cold hand on his forehead. It felt like a wet silk scarf against his skin.
Now, perhaps I can do a good turn for you.
And with that, she began to mutter to herself, mumbling words that Bod could not make out. Then she said, clear and loud,
be whole, be dust, be dream, be wind, be night, be dark, be wish, be mind. Now slip, now slide, now move unseen, above, beneath, betwixt, between.
Something huge touched him, brushed him from head to feet, and he shivered. His hair prickled, and his skin was all goose flesh. Something had changed.
What did you do?
Just give you a helping hand. I may be dead, but I'm a dead witch, remember, and we don't forget.
But...
Hush up! They're coming back!
The key rattled in the storeroom lock.
Now then, chummy, I'm sure we're all going to be great friends.
And with that, Tom Hustings pushed open the door. Then he stood in the doorway, looking around, looking puzzled. He was a big, big man, with foxy red hair and a bottle-red nose.
Here, Ebenezer. I thought you said he was in here.
I did.
Well, I can't see hide nor hair of him.
Bulger's face appeared behind the ruddy man's, and he peered into the room.
Hiding?
He said, staring straight at where Bod was standing.
No use hiding. I can see you there. Come on out.
The two men walked into the little room, and Bod stood stock still between them and thought of Mr. Pennyworth's lessons. He did not react. He did not move. He let the men's glances slide from him without seeing him.
You're going to wish you'd come out when I called.
And he shut the door.
Right. You block the door so he can't get past.
And with that, he walked around the room, peering behind things and bending awkwardly to look beneath the desk. He walked straight past Bod and opened the cupboard.
Now I see you. Come out.
Liza giggled.
What was that?
Asked Tom Hustings, spinning round.
I didn't hear nothing.
Liza giggled again. Then she put her lips together and blew, making a noise that began as a whistling and then sounded like a distant wind. The electric lights in the little room flickered and buzzed. Then they went out.
Bloody fuses! This is a waste of time!
The key clicked in the lock, and Liza and Bod were left alone in the room.
He's got away.
Bod could hear him now through the door.
Well, not that. There wasn't anywhere he could have been hiding. We'd have seen him if he was.
The man Jack won't like that.
Who's going to tell him?
A pause.
Here, Tom Hustings, where's the brooch gone?
That? Here, I was keeping it safe.
Keeping it safe? In your pocket? Funny place to be keeping it safe, if you ask me. More like you were planning to make off with it, like you was planning to keep my brooch for your own.
Your brooch, Ebenezer? Your brooch? Our brooch, you mean?
Ours indeed. I don't remember you being here when I got it from that boy.
That boy that you couldn't even keep safe for the man Jack, you mean? Can you imagine what he'll do when he finds you had the boy he was looking for and you let him go?
Probably not the same boy. Lots of boys in the world. What are the odds it was the one he was looking for? Out the back door as soon as my back was turned, I'll bet. Don't you worry about the man Jack, Tom Hustings. I'm sure that it was a different boy, my old mind playing tricks. And we're almost out of slow gin. How would you fancy a good scotch? I've whiskey in the back room. You just wait here a moment.
The storeroom door was unlocked, and Ebenezer entered, holding a walking stick and a flashlight, looking even more sour of face than before.
If you're still in here, don't even think of making a run for it. I've called the police on you, that's what I've done.
A rummage in a drawer produced the half-filled bottle of whiskey, and then a tiny black bottle. Ebenezer poured several drops from the little bottle into the larger. Then he pocketed the tiny bottle.
My brooch, and mine alone.
Just come in, Tom.
He glared around the dark room, staring past Bod. Then he left the storeroom, carrying the whiskey in front of him. He locked the door behind him.
"Here you go,"
came Abenazar Bulger's voice through the door.
"Give us your glass then, Tom. Nice drop of scotch put hairs on your chest. Say when."
Silence.
"Cheap muck. Aren't you drinking?"
"That slow gin's gone to my innards. Give it a minute for my stomach to settle. Here, Tom, what have you done with my brooch?"
"Your brooch, is it now? Oh, what did you... You put something in my drink, you little grub."
"What if I did? I could read on your face what you was planning, Tom Hustings. Thief."
And then there was shouting, and several crashes and loud bangs, as if heavy items of furniture were being overturned. Then, silence.
"Quickly now, let's get you out of here."
"But the door's locked."
He looked at her.
"Is there something you can do?"
"Me? I don't have any magics will get you out of a locked room, boy."
Bod crouched and peered out through the keyhole. It was blocked. The key sat in the keyhole. Bod thought. Then he smiled momentarily, and it lit his face like the flash of a light bulb. He pulled a crumpled sheet of newspaper from a packing case, flattened it out as best he could, then pushed it underneath the door, leaving only a corner on his side of the doorway.
"What are you playing at?"
"I need something like a pencil, only thinner. Here we go."
And he took a thin paintbrush from the top of the desk and pushed the brushless end into the lock, jiggled it, and pushed some more. There was a muffled clunk as the key was pushed out, as it dropped from the lock onto the newspaper. Bod pulled the paper back under the door, now with the key sitting on it. Liza laughed, delighted.
"That's wit, young man. That's wisdom."
Bod put the key in the lock, turned it and pushed open the storeroom door. There were two men on the floor, in the middle of the crowded antique shop. Furniture had indeed fallen. The place was a chaos of wrecked clocks and chairs, and in the midst of it, the bulk of Tom Hustings lay, fallen on the smaller figure of Abenazar Bulger. Neither of them was moving.
"Are they dead?"
"No such luck."
On the floor beside the men was a brooch of glittering silver, a crimson-orange-banded stone held in place with claws and with snake heads, and the expression on the snake heads was one of triumph and avarice and satisfaction. Bod dropped the brooch into his pocket, where it sat beside the heavy glass paperweight, the paintbrush, and the little pot of paint.
"Take this, too."
Bod looked at the black-edged card, with the word Jack handwritten on one side. It disturbed him. There was something familiar about it, something that stirred old memories, something dangerous.
"I don't want it."
"You can't leave it here with them. They were going to use it to hurt you."
"I don't want it. It's bad. Burn it."
"No, don't do that. You mustn't do that."
"Then I'll give it to Silas."
And he put the little card into an envelope, so he had to touch it as little as possible, and put the envelope into the inside pocket of his old gardening jacket, beside his heart. 200 miles away, the man Jack woke from his sleep and sniffed the air. He walked downstairs.
"What is it?"
asked his grandmother, stirring the contents of a big iron pot on the stove.
"What's got in here now?"
"I don't know. Something's happening. Something interesting."
And then he licked his lips.
"Smells tasty. Very tasty."
Lightning illuminated the cobbled street. Bod hurried through the rain, through the old town, always heading up the hill toward the graveyard. The grey day had become an early night while he was inside the storeroom, and it came as no surprise to him when a familiar shadow swirled beneath the street lamps. Bod hesitated, and a flutter of night-black velvet resolved itself into a man-shape. Silas stood in front of him, arms folded. He strode forward impatiently.
Well?
I'm sorry, Silas.
I'm disappointed in you, Bod. I've been looking for you since I woke. You have the smell of trouble all around you, and you know you're not allowed to go out here into the living world.
I know. I'm sorry.
There was rain on the boy's face, running down like tears.
First of all, we need to get you back to safety.
Silas reached down and enfolded the living child inside his cloak, and Bod felt the ground fall away beneath him.
Silas?
Silas did not answer.
I was a bit scared. But I knew you'd come and get me if it got too bad. And Liza was there. She helped a lot.
Liza?
The witch. From the Potter's Field.
And you say she helped you?
Yes. She especially helped me with my fading. I think I can do it now.
Silas grunted.
You can tell me all about it when we're home.
And Bod was quiet until they landed beside the chapel. They went inside, into the empty hall, as the rain redoubled, splashing up from the puddles that covered the ground. Bod produced the envelope containing the black-edged card.
I thought you should have this. Well, Liza did, really.
Silas looked at it. Then he opened it, removed the card, stared at it, turned it over, and read Abenazar Bulger's penciled note to himself, in tiny handwriting, explaining the precise manner of use of the card.
Tell me everything.
Bod told him everything he could remember about the day. And at the end, Silas shook his head slowly, thoughtfully.
Am I in trouble?
Nobody, Owens, you are indeed in trouble. However, I believe I shall leave it to your parents to administer whatever discipline and reproach they believe to be needed. In the meantime, I need to dispose of this.
The black-edged card vanished inside the velvet cloak, and then, in the manner of his kind, Silas was gone. Bod pulled the jacket up over his head and clambered up the slippery paths to the top of the hill, to the Frobisher Mausoleum. He pulled aside Ephraim Pettifer's coffin, and he went down and down and still further down. He replaced the brooch beside the goblet and the knife.
Here you go. All polished up. Looking pretty.
It comes back. It always comes back.
It had been a long night. Bod was walking sleepily and a little gingerly past the small tomb of the wonderfully named Miss Liberty Roach. What she spent is lost, what she gave remains with her always. Reader, be charitable. Past the final resting place of Harrison Westwood Baker of this parish and his wives, Marion and Joan, to the Potter's Field. Mr. and Mrs. Owens had died several hundred years before it had been decided that beating children was wrong, and Mr. Owens had, regretfully, that night, done what he saw as his duty, and Bod's bottom stung like anything. Still, the look of worry on Mrs. Owens' face had hurt Bod worse than any beating could have done. He reached the iron railings that bounded the Potter's Field and slipped between them.
Hello?
There was no answer. Not even an extra shadow in the hawthorn tree.
I hope I didn't get you into trouble too.
Nothing. He had replaced the jeans in the gardener's hut. He was more comfortable in just his grey winding sheet, but he had kept the jacket. He liked having the pockets. When he had gone to the shed to return the jeans, he had taken a small hand scythe from the wall where it hung, and with it he attacked the nettle patch in the potter's field, sending the nettles flying, slashing and cutting them, till there was nothing but stinging stubble on the ground. From his pocket he took the large glass paperweight, its insides a multitude of bright colours, along with the paint pot and the paint brush. He dipped the brush into the paint and carefully painted in brown paint on the surface of the paperweight the letters E.H. And beneath them he wrote, "We don't forget." Bedtime soon, and it would not be wise for him to be late to bed for some time to come. He put the paperweight down on the ground that had once been a nettle patch, placed it in the place that he estimated her head would have been, and pausing only to look at his handiwork for a moment, he went through the railings and made his way, rather less gingerly, back up the hill.
"Not bad,"
said a pert voice from the potter's field behind him.
"Not bad at all."
But when he turned to look, there was no one there.
Chapter 5. Dance Macabre.
Something was going on. Bod was certain of it. It was there in the crisp winter air, in the stars, in the wind, in the darkness. It was there in the rhythms of the long nights and the fleeting days.
Mistress Owens pushed him out of the Owens's little tomb.
"Get along with you. I've got business to attend to."
Bod looked at his mother.
"But it's cold out there."
"I should hope so, it being winter. That's as it should be. Now, shoes. And look at this dress, it needs hemming. And cobwebs. There are cobwebs all over, for heaven's sakes. You get along. I've plenty to be getting on with, and I don't need you underfoot."
And then she sang to herself a little couplet Bod had never heard before.
"Rich man, poor man, come away, come to dance the macabre."
"What's that?"
But it was the wrong thing to have said, for Mistress Owens looked dark as a thundercloud, and Bod hurried out of the tomb before she could express her displeasure more forcefully. It was cold in the graveyard, cold and dark, and the stars were already out. Bod passed Mother Slaughter in the ivy-covered Egyptian walk, squinting at the greenery.
"Your eyes are younger than mine, young man. Can you see Blossom?"
"Blossom? In winter?"
"Don't you look at me with that face on, young man. Things blossom in their time. They bud and bloom, blossom and fade. Everything in its time."
She huddled deeper into her cloak and bonnet, and she said,
"Time to work, and time to play, time to dance the macabre. Eh, boy?"
"I don't know. What's the macabre?"
But Mother Slaughter had pushed into the ivy and was gone from sight.
"How odd."
He sought warmth and company in the bustling Bartleby mausoleum, but the Bartleby family, 7 generations of them, had no time for him that night. They were cleaning and tidying, all of them, from the oldest, died 1831, to the youngest, died 1690. Fortinbras Bartleby, 10 years old when he had died, of consumption, he had told Bod, who had mistakenly believed for several years that Fortinbras had been eaten by lions or bears, and was extremely disappointed to learn it was merely a disease, now apologized to Bod.
"We cannot stop to play, Master Bod, for soon enough tomorrow night comes, and how often can a man say that?"
"Every night. Tomorrow night always comes."
"Not this one. Not once in a blue moon or a month of Sundays."
"It's not Guy Fawkes night or Halloween. It's not Christmas or New Year's Day."
Fortinbras smiled, a huge smile that filled his pie-shaped, freckly face with joy.
"None of them. This one's special."
"What's it called? What happens tomorrow?"
"It's the best day."
And Bod was certain he would have continued, but his grandmother, Louisa Bartleby, who was only 20, called him over to her and said something sharply in his ear.
"Nothing."
Then, to Bod,
"Sorry, I have to work now."
And he took a rag and began to buff the side of his dusty coffin with it.
"La, la, la, oop. La, 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 oop."
And with each oomp, he would do a wild, whole-body flourish with his rag.
"Aren't you going to sing that song?"
"What song?"
"The one everybody's singing."
"No time for that. It's tomorrow. Tomorrow after all."
"No time,"
said Louisa, who had died in childbirth, giving birth to twins.
"Be about your business."
And in her sweet, clear voice, she sang,
"One and all will hear and stay, come and dance the macabre."
Bod walked down to the crumbling little church. He slipped between the stones and into the crypt, where he sat and waited for Silas to return. He was cold, true, but the cold did not bother Bod. Not really. The graveyard embraced him, and the dead do not mind the cold. His guardian returned in the small hours of the morning. He had a large plastic bag with him.
"What's in there?"
"Clothes. For you. Try them on."
Silas produced a grey sweater, the colour of Bod's winding sheet, a pair of jeans, underwear, and shoes. Pale green sneakers.
"What are they for?"
"You mean apart from wearing? Well, firstly, I think you're old enough. What are you, 10 years old now? And normal, living people clothes are wise. You'll have to wear them one day, so why not pick up the habit right now? And they could also be camouflage."
"What's camouflage?"
"When something looks enough like something else, the people watching don't know what it is they're looking at."
"Oh, I see. I think."
Bod put the clothes on. The shoelaces gave him a little trouble, and Silas had to teach him how to tie them. It seemed remarkably complicated to Bod, and he had to tie and retie his laces several times before he had done it to Silas's satisfaction. Only then did Bod dare to ask his question.
"Silas, what's a macabre?"
Silas's eyebrows raised and his head tipped to one side.
"Where did you hear about that?"
"Everyone in the graveyard is talking about it. I think it's something that happens tomorrow night. What's a macabre?"
"It's a dance."
"All must dance the macabre. Have you danced it? What kind of dance is it?"
His guardian looked at him with eyes like black pools, and said,
"I do not know. I know many things, Bod, for I have been walking this earth at night for a very long time. But I do not know what it is like to dance the macabre. You must be alive, or you must be dead to dance it. And I am neither."
Bod shivered. He wanted to embrace his guardian, to hold him, and tell him that he would never desert him. But the action was unthinkable. He could no more hug Silas than he could hold a moonbeam, not because his guardian was insubstantial, but because it would be wrong. There were people you could hug. And then there was Silas. His guardian inspected Bod thoughtfully. A boy in his new clothes.
You'll do. Now you look like you've lived outside the graveyard all your life.
Bod smiled proudly. Then the smile stopped, and he looked grave once again.
But you'll always be here, Silas, won't you? And I won't ever have to leave if I don't want to.
Everything in its season.
And he said no more that night. Bod woke early the next day, when the sun was a silver coin high in the grey winter sky. It was too easy to sleep through the hours of daylight, to spend all his winter in one long night and never see the sun, and so, each night before he slept, he would promise himself that he would wake in daylight and leave the Owens's cosy tomb. There was a strange scent in the air, sharp and floral. Bod followed it up the hill to the Egyptian walk, where the winter ivy hung in green tumbles, an evergreen tangle that hid the mock Egyptian walls and statues and hieroglyphs. The perfume was heaviest there, and for a moment Bod wondered if snow might have fallen, for there were white clusters on the greenery. Bod examined a cluster more closely. It was made of small, five-petaled flowers, and he had just put his head in to sniff the perfume when he heard footsteps coming up the path. Bod faded into the ivy and watched. Three men and a woman, all alive, came up the path and into the Egyptian walk. The woman had an ornate chain around her neck.
Is this it?
Yes, Mrs. Carroway,
said one of the men, chubby and white-haired and short of breath. Like each of the men, he carried a large, empty wicker basket. She seemed both vague and puzzled.
Well, if you say so, but I cannot say that I understand it.
She looked up at the flowers.
What do I do now?
The smallest of the men reached into his wicker basket and brought out a tarnished pair of silver scissors.
The scissors, Lady Mayoress.
She took the scissors from him and began to cut the clumps of blossom, and she and the three men started to fill the baskets with the flowers.
This is perfectly ridiculous,
said Mrs. Carroway, the Lady Mayoress. After a little while.
It is a tradition.
Perfectly ridiculous.
But she continued to cut the white blossoms and drop them into the wicker baskets. When they had filled the first basket, she asked,
Isn't that enough?
We need to fill all four baskets and then distribute a flower to everyone in the old town.
And what kind of tradition is that? I asked the Lord Mayor before me, and he said he'd never heard of it. Do you get a feeling someone's watching us?
What?
Said the third man, who had not spoken until now. He had a beard and a turban and two wicker baskets.
Ghosts, you mean? I do not believe in ghosts.
Not ghosts, just a feeling like someone's looking.
Bod fought the urge to push further back into the ivy.
It's not surprising that the previous Lord Mayor did not know about this tradition,
said the chubby man, whose basket was almost full.
It's the first time the winter blossoms have bloomed in 80 years.
The man with the beard and the turban, who did not believe in ghosts, was looking around him nervously.
Everyone in the old town gets a flower. Man, woman, and child.
Then he said, slowly, as if he were trying to remember something he had learned a very long time ago.
One to leave and one to stay, and all to dance the macabre.
Mrs. Carroway sniffed.
Stuff and nonsense,
and kept on snipping the blossoms. Dusk fell early in the afternoon, and it was night by 4:30. Bod wandered the paths of the graveyard, looking for someone to talk to. But there was no one about. He walked down to the potter's field to see if Liza